Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome back to This Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunge, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm dandy.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and controversies, it looks like Paramount has finally been sold. After stops and starts aplenty, Sherry Redstone, who controls the Paramount Viacom empire via her holding company, National Amusements, has agreed to terms with David Ellison, who owns Skydance, a studio behind theatrical hits like Top Gun Maverick and streaming hits like The Family Plan and Ghosted, both of which debuted on Apple TV+, for Skydance to essentially merge with Paramount in a complicated deal. It's worth about $8 billion. There are some regulatory hurdles to clear as Paramount Viacom owns CBS, and any transfer of a TV network triggers an automatic FCC review. Plus, there are some standard antitrust things to consider, though I think the FTC is going to be less worried about this deal than it might have been about a similar deal between, say, Paramount and Sony. I'm not super interested in the financial shenanigans that are part of this deal. The merger and acquisition folks will have a better understanding and be more nuanced about the ins and outs of what it means to acquire National Amusements and the voting and controlling shares of Paramount, as opposed to the general shares, which are non-voting. None of that is that interesting to me. But it is a very important inflection moment for the studio as a producer of entertainment product, right? It's an incredibly interesting time. We're going to see what Ellison does, not only with Paramount Studios, you know, one of the most storied film studios in history, made The Godfather and, you know, Beverly Hills Cop, the original one. We're going to be talking about that more in a minute. But also CBS Network, right? The cable network. Networks like Nickelodeon and BET, which BET itself has been on the block for a while, could be sold before this deal is even finalized. We'll see what happens there. And then there's also the studio's struggling streaming platform, Paramount Plus. What's going to happen with that? We don't know, and we won't know for a while what precisely Ellison is going to do, but I think we've got some pretty good hints from incoming President Jeff Shell's call about the deal with analysts and investors. First up, he talked about linear TV, which is declining, but slowly. It's declining, but it's in slow decline, which means that CBS, the network, remains relatively valuable, even as that audience starts to dry up, right? Linear cable is collapsing much more quickly. Cord cutting is picking up speed, while original content is shifting to streaming. Cable channels are simply becoming less valuable. Streaming itself is a big question for Paramount, as Paramount Plus continues to bleed money, just like hundreds of millions of dollars every quarter. And Shell said that Paramount won't hoard content for the streaming service, but instead sell it to other platforms. That's a move we've seen Warner Brothers and HBO Max do recently. Ellison insists that they aren't waving the white flag on streaming. He said that they want to improve the user interface and, you know, he wants to use algorithms to get the ads to the people. Right, sure,
yes.
Whatever that means. We'll see.
I love that.
We'll see what that means. But then there's the movie studio. And the movie studio, of course, is what I'm probably most interested in here. You know, Skydance itself has adopted a pretty aggressive strategy of funding big budget theatrical first movies, particularly in the franchise vein, right? There was a couple of Terminator movies, both of which kind of flopped. And then he has also backed the most recent Mission Impossible films, the Top Gun Maverick, of course. But they've also played very heavily in the streaming realm, right? They've backed movies like Michael Bay's Six Underground and The Old Guard for Netflix. They made The Family Plan and Luck for Apple. Projects like Without Remorse, which was a TV show, and The Tomorrow War both went to Amazon. And The Tomorrow War is a pretty interesting example here. It really demonstrates Skydance's flexibility. Originally, that had been planned as a theatrical release, potentially a new franchise vehicle for Chris Pratt, who, of course, is the star of several different franchises. But then the pandemic happened, which led to Paramount and Skydance selling the movie to Amazon, which released it on their platform to huge numbers, didn't get a theatrical release, just went straight to the streamer. And, you know, they put out a bunch of anecdotes that said, most viewed original of all time for us, whatever. Who knows what any of those numbers mean? I don't know. All of which is to say that Paramount Skydance as an entity seems pretty well poised to be flexible as it moves into the future. Now, Peter, I'm one thing that I'm really interested in this move is the idea of David Ellison as like an old school movie fan, this isn't like selling Paramount to Seagram's Ginger Ale or whatever, as happened back in the olden days, the before times, right? This is a studio being picked up by a guy who has shown that he has a love for movies and entertainment. And I think that matters, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that's obviously right. In fact, that's part of the pitch here, is that this is a return to having a creative film executive at the top of a major studio or something like one. And that's something that we haven't necessarily seen, certainly not, somebody who is relatively young. Ellison is just 41 years old, younger than I am. And he likes movies, and that's good if you're going to run a movie studio. And this is a sort of interestingly both promising and perilous time for the business of movies. We've talked about that quite a bit on this podcast, but I think all of us are kind of united in the belief that on the one hand, things as we have seen them over the last several years are not fully working, and something is going to have to change. On the other hand, it's not, we're not in a situation where no movie can make any money. And in fact, what you've seen over the course of the summer is that while there certainly have been some notable duds or movies that have failed to perform, even if we have liked them and thought they were quite solid, just sort of as creative enterprises, movies that are well targeted, well marketed, and positioned at the right budget level can still do quite well. And so I think there's probably some sort of it would be great to see someone with a lot of resources who really cares about movies and who now can, as you said, sort of move in this flexible, in this flexible way, try to look at what it is that you can do to put together a slate of films, maybe not just all $200 million superhero movies, maybe not just all $5 million horror movies, something that sort of runs the gamut in between that, and see what you can do to sort of better think about how to build successful film products where the creative works, people like the movies and they like them enough that you want to make more of them, or you want to sort of build spinoffs, right? That they're sort of, that they leave a warm glow in people's hearts and they just sort of like they make that connection, but also that they're not over budgeted monstrosities that, start with $250 million worth of production and then also require a similar amount in marketing. And then you got to make $1 billion before anybody even sees any money. And like, it just seems like all of the people who care about movies, who both care about the movies themselves and the movie business, seem to be like in on the same page. And like, the business part of this isn't working, right? The product development part of this isn't working the right way because it went way too far in the direction of we're only going to, superhero movies in particular, but just sort of we're only going to build a couple of things around, sort of really well-known IP. We're going to spend way too much and hope that that stuff works. And it would just like, I think the time is, it is an opportune moment for an executive like this to come in and make a splash. And it's a real opportunity. And I'm very curious to see what we end up with here.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly an interesting time, Alyssa, but I do wonder if, look, we are whistling past the graveyard in certain respects on this podcast a lot of the time. But I do wonder if this isn't, you know, one of these cases where you get a little bit of hope and that's a bad thing. Hope can be bad. That's the soul killer.
So do you want me to restore hope to you? Do you want me to crush your hope so that you'll?
I don't know.
You know,
I don't know. Should we be hopeful or should we banish that thought from our mind?
Alyssa, you've got to be pro hope on this podcast. If you're not pro hope, then there is no hope.
Wow.
It's like the Chris Hemsworth line from Furiosa, right? We stole your, what is it? What does he say? We stole your hope. There's hope. It's bullshit. There's no such thing.
There's no hope.
That's right. Yeah.
So that's a lot to put on me, and I'm not sure that I can meet expectations. But look, I mean, personally, if I was going to pick one of the Ellison siblings whose tastes in movies I prefer, I like the movies that Megan Ellison has made with Annapurna a lot more than I broadly like the movies that David Ellison has made with Skydance. And considering that Zero Dark Thirty is one of my favorite movies of the last 20 years, it's probably pretty hard to, you know, go up against that. But yeah, look, I mean, I don't know that I think David Ellison is going to make movies that are my favorite movies ever, but I think the fact that he has sort of Catholic tastes in the movies that he makes, and that he is willing to try a lot of different things, work in a lot of different genres at a lot of different scales for a bunch of different distribution platforms, probably means that he has a better shot at being successful on a large scale than his sister does, who, you know, she tends to invest in, you know, excellent teams who are doing kind of risky, interesting stuff. And that, of course, doesn't always pay off. She also works at sort of a lower volume than he does. You know, I don't know. I mean, I understand why you don't want to talk a lot about the financing, Sonny. Although if people are interested in the financing, Matt Levine did a very fun episode of his podcast, Money Stuff, on this. But my understanding is that part of the deal pays down a bunch of Paramount's debt, which is, frankly, a good thing if it leaves the studio with a little bit more room to maneuver, a little less sort of stress on some of its projects. So I don't have a strong case for either hope or despair. I think it's good that Paramount's going to survive. And my hope is that by sort of bringing a more rational corporate structure to the whole enterprise and maybe paying down some of the debt, Paramount will have a little bit more room to be experimental, to figure out a strategy. And I'm just sort of curious to see where it goes.
You know, the comparison with Annapurna is an interesting one. So for folks who don't know, Annapurna Studios, which is the studio that made Zero Dark Thirty, I think a bunch of movies. Annapurna made a whole bunch of movies in the aughts and early teens, and then kind of blew up a little bit because the problem was they were making mid-budget films for not mid-budget prices, really, is what it came down to. They were just spending way too much money on stuff that was of limited commercial viability. And I do think that's an interesting comparison point because, look, I agree. I am with you in the sense that, like, if you gave me the average Annapurna movie versus the average Skydance movie, I'm probably going with the average Annapurna movie in terms of what I want to watch, right? That's more my taste, more my speed. But Skydance is inarguably more successful.
Oh, no question.
They've done a much better job at capturing, you know, audiences and working in budget ranges that worked for the movies, and also, frankly, working with streaming studios, working with streaming partners, you know, getting money from Apple TV Plus to make things instead of risking the theatrical exposure. And look, I am a guy who obviously I believe very strongly in the theatrical experience. I think movies are better off in theaters than going straight to streaming, et cetera, et cetera. But I do think that, like, from a pure business standpoint, there are movies that are better on streaming and movies that are destined to do better on streaming than in theaters. And I think Skydance has done a really good job of kind of balancing that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in my dream world, Annapurna would end up as, like, the sort of Miramax would end up. I would love a scenario where Paramount was to Annapurna what Disney was to Miramax for a while, right? Like, it would be, I would love to kind of see, you know, a situation where you combine some of the, you know, the taste involved in Annapurna with some of the, you know, sort of overall corporate savvy and maybe financial discipline of a larger company.
It would Annapurna be cool. Can be the new Touchstone.
Right.
Yeah, right. Like Touchstone or the new Focus Features division. To Universal
exactly.
or,
exactly.
you know, the 20th Century Fox and Searchlight picture, you know, like whatever. I that would be great. I don't know. It's not 100% clear to me how in sync the Ellison siblings are in terms of their taste and work life and all that. But, you know,
yeah, I don't think we know about that. But here's the bottom line. This is new blood, right? This is young, relatively young, fresh blood coming in to become not just a Hollywood power player, but something above that, a Hollywood mega power player. And it's young, fresh blood from someone who has a pretty good track record of working within the weird financial constraints that we have seen develop over the last 10 years or so with streaming and also COVID and all that sort of mess with movie theaters. And it's someone who loves movies, like actually just likes them, right? Like is there for the movie experience as much as for the part where you get to hang out with celebrities and make a ton of money. And that seems to me like all things being equal, that's a pretty good trifecta, right? Like that's what you want in Hollywood right now is fresh blood who has a good track record and actually loves the art itself. Like, I'm giving this is good. Like that's what you, if you didn't know what was going to happen next, but all you knew was that, you would say, those are the things we want. You are hiring for this role. You would say, that's what we want, is somebody who has a track record, somebody who's relatively young, and somebody who loves the form.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And look, you know, Richard Rushfield, sort of friend of the pod, has written about sort of Hollywood's gerontocracy, right? And, you know, if nothing else, this signals a welcome generational transition at a time when those are proving surprisingly difficult to pull off in so many areas of American life. And, you know, I welcome our millennial studio heads. It's good to have representation in the upper echelons of power.
I was going to say, I was reading a story about this and I did not realize, I actually thought he was slightly younger than me, but he is, David Ellison is exactly my age. So good for him. It's about time one of us caught a break. 41-year-old kid.
I think he caught a break when he was born to a billionaire.
Yeah, well, that's
Larry
the
Ellison
other,
might not have been a billionaire when he was
the
born.
The other factor here, of course, is that Larry Ellison has, you know, who is really the primary investor in all this, has like $80 billion to spare. So, you know, if a couple bad summers aren't going to sink Paramount.
I don't know,
so,
man. You can spend $80 billion in movie money real fast.
I thought Larry Ellison had like $137 billion. He has a lot of billions of dollars.
Whatever. He has some inordinate number of billions. Hopefully he spends them all on Paramount. Makes a real go of it. All right. So what do we think? Is the merger of Paramount and Skydance a controversy or a non-controversy? Alyssa?
It's a non-controversy. It's, you know, perfectly reasonable business deal.
Peter?
It's a non-controversy.
Non-troversy. It's a non-troversy. It's good for everybody. I'm, you know, the thing I really want to see is what they do with CBS, because I think broadcast networks are underrated as an asset still. Even everyone's like, oh, they're going away. They're not going away.
Yeah, well,
cable networks.
And CBS has been the one that has done the best at sort of maintaining an actual primetime audience.
Yeah.
So that's promising.
All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for a bonus episode on John Landau, who passed away last weekend at the age of 63. He's not precisely a household name, but the films he produced certainly are. James Cameron's longtime producing partner. He was a key part of bringing films like Titanic and the Avatar movies to life. Also worked pretty closely on the Alita Battle Angel movie, which I personally am a big fan of. Underrated flick. We'll talk about the life of a producer on this Friday's bonus episode, so tune in then. And now on to the main event. Beverly Hills Cop, Axel F. I really feel like they should have just gone with a 4, but whatever. Streaming now on Netflix, this legacy sequel, reboot, rebrand, whatever. It's some 30 years in the making. And I just want to, before we get started, I want to lay my cards on the table. I am not and have never been a huge fan of Beverly Hills Cop. Like, don't get me wrong. I like it. I like it fine. It's perfectly fine. It's occasionally very funny. You can understand how Eddie Murphy became one of the biggest stars in the world watching this movie. But it was not a foundational part of my childhood or anything like that, is all I'm saying. I don't have a huge reservoir of nostalgia for it, right? It's not a foundational part of what I watch movies for growing up. And yet, still, I have to say, when The Heat Is On started blaring in the opening credits and that synth-heavy score kicked in, you know, the doot-doot-doot-doot-doot-doot-doot-doot, that one, right? I was like, okay, this reminds me of things I liked once upon a time, and now I like this. But the real nostalgia comes from what this as a, this is, this picture is, what it represents as a whole. And that's a fairly straightforward 1980s high concept star vehicle, right? Eddie Murphy plays Axel Foley. He's the consummate Detroit cop. He's a little outrageous. He's happy to destroy some public and private property if it means catching the bad guys and getting the job done. After hearing from an old buddy in Los Angeles, Rosewood, played once again by Judge Reinhold, about how Axel's estranged daughter, Jane, who's played by Taylor Page, is in trouble, Axel heads back to the City of Angels, where he runs into a bunch of old friends, and he makes some new enemies, and yada yada yada, hijinks ensue, crimes are thwarted, good times are had by all. And I don't feel like there's much value in breaking down the plot of this movie or what really makes sense or what doesn't, what shows up as pure member berries, right? The performances are all pretty fine. This is the second time in as many weeks I've seen Kevin Bacon play a delightful 80s-coded villain, right? He was in Maxine as a corrupt private eye. Here he is in Axel F as a corrupt cop wearing Gucci loafers. He does it. He does corruption. I love it. It's always nice to see Bronson Pinchot show up and do a silly accent. Paul Reiser, love you, buddy. Where you been? Good to have you back. Like I said, though, this is a really solid simulacrum of a 1980s buddy cop movie. Is it formulaic? Yes. Does it have a fairly straightforward three-act structure? Yes. Is the plot so flimsy the only thing holding together your suspension of disbelief is Eddie Murphy and his raw star power? You know it. That is what is most interesting. Or that is not what is most interesting. What's most interesting is the things that are kind of similar yet wholly different. For example, the montage of the Detroit in the original. It's funny, I went back and watched the original because I was like, maybe I'm underrating it. No, I'm rating it about right. But if you go back and watch the original, there's a montage of Detroit that's very similar to the montage of Detroit at the start of this film. And the montage of Detroit in 1980s is like, it is a city that has been destroyed by industrial flight. It is like filled with genuine poverty. You've got like people sitting on the corner of the street with their head in their hands, like hunkered down on the ground, just drinking openly in the streets and on the sidewalks. It's like a city that is run down and looks bad. In the sequel, meanwhile, it just kind of positions Detroit as like kind of kooky. It's got some character to it. You know, the guys dressed up all weird. And that is, it's interesting to think about the way films portrayed a certain sort of poverty in the 1980s and don't like to now. Anyway, I think this is an almost perfect Netflix movie. And what I mean by that is, it's a sort of franchise movie that has some name recognition, but it would still likely be pretty hard to get people to go to theaters to see, right? It's got a big name people like. It's shot in a way that's like not really aggressive or confusing or particularly interesting. Beverly Hills Cop has never been a visually adventurous film, precisely, though the first sequel, which was directed by Tony Scott, definitely looks like a Tony Scott movie. Axel F. absolutely looks like a TV movie. This is a movie that was made for TV, albeit a relatively expensive TV movie. And that's fine. That's fine. The whole thing is fine. It's a perfectly acceptable 2 hours. Makes you feel good. Reminds you of the way things used to be and how they used to be better. I think that's about enough. Is it enough, Alyssa? Is it enough just to be fine?
Yeah, it's enough to be fine. I mean, I enjoyed this movie most for just the reminder of what Eddie Murphy can do, right? And, you know, Richard Brody has written a couple of really great pieces about just sort of the kind of tragedy of the way in which he feels Murphy's talents have been understood and kind of led him into cinematic exile in a way that is kind of a larger failing of American culture and just a waste of Murphy's talent. You know, and it's just part of what's fun about this movie is watching Murphy play a whole bunch of different characters in one, right? Like, he's Axel Foley, but he's also, you know, pretending to, you know, he just takes on all of these little roles in the course of doing his job as a cop that remind you of just his range and vivacity and vitality. Have you guys seen Bowfinger? Came out a million years ago.
Yes, but probably not since I was, I don't know, 20 or something. Yeah. Maybe even younger.
Yeah. For folks who haven't seen it, it's super worth watching. It's a very strange movie. Basically, Steve Martin plays a movie producer who has lied to his financial backers about being able to get a huge star, played by Eddie Murphy, in his movie. And he, of course, doesn't have the star attached. So he finds sort of a lookalike, also played by Eddie Murphy, and they kind of shoot around the actual star by, like, running up to him in the street. And it's a much, you know, it's a much more interesting display of Murphy's talents than we have here. But, you know, just watching this movie, it's like, goddamn, we couldn't find some more things to do with Eddie Murphy. That seems weird and wrong and unfortunate. And I also just, I enjoy Taylor Page in this a lot. Like, I don't know if you guys watched Zola, which came out sort of during the tail end of the pandemic. She plays a stripper who, you know, sort of takes a job that goes very badly wrong. It's based on this viral Twitter thread. And she's just like, she's an awesome screen presence. She has a very expressive face. She, you know, again, like, does not have anything near Murphy's breadth, but just like, she can really hold a screen. I find her very compelling. And she and Joseph Gordon-Levitt are just kind of fun to watch in the background of this movie. So is this a good movie? No, not particularly. But it is amusing. And it is, you know, it is nice to have something that's this resolutely mid kind of classed up by some of the acting talent that is scattered throughout it.
Yeah, I'll say it was also very nice to see Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who I've not seen in a movie of this sort, this size, in a while. So also good to see him
good
on
actor.
Screen again. Peter, I got the sense that you thought that this was like the most average movie that has ever been made in our
Ever hit the 2-star mark harder than Beverly Hills Cop. Axel F. This is the most just okay of just okay movies. I was not happy to be watching it. I was not unhappy to be watching it. I felt absolutely nothing. I was like one of those emojis. It doesn't have a smile in it. It just has the straight line. There's no feeling at all. I was just like, I was just there. And the there-ness was so just there. So I agree with a lot of what you said, Sonny, and also with what Alyssa said. This is a perfect Netflix movie in its disposability in so many ways. It is occasionally elevated by some better than average performances, in particular Eddie Murphy, who just acts circles around everyone. It is occasionally elevated by Eddie Murphy, who just acts circles around everyone, including some other pretty good performers. You can see Kevin Bacon is better than a sort of bog standard villain here, except that he has absolutely nothing to do. The thing that works about him is not anything that is inherent to the role. It's just Kevin Bacon. What was most interesting to me about this movie, though, and the thing that I want to raise to you guys is one of the screenwriters on this film was also a screenwriter on Bad Boys 4, Bad Boys Ride or Die. And this movie actually was originally supposed to be directed by the same pair of directors who directed Bad Boys 4. One thing you can say about that movie in retrospect is it was much more visually interesting than this. But there's just a lot of continuity between this film and the two updated Bad Boys movies. They have brought in children characters as a way of helping the protagonists, or protagonists, I guess, in the case of the Bad Boys. But right, like Will Smith had a son who just showed up in Bad Boys 3 20 years later. Also, maybe an X-Fling who was a witch. Anyway, we'll forget about that. And the son character helped sort of bring out kind of more mature feelings and helped him reckon with his sort of immature earlier days, you know, when he was vulgar and young and just running and gunning. And you see a lot of that here where the Eddie Murphy character's daughter, Jane Saunders, played by Taylor Page, shows up to, in some ways, provide a contrast, but in other ways to serve as a, I don't know, a touch, like a point of consideration for like, hey, man, weren't you actually, wasn't the movie is in some ways kind of trying to distance the character from his old antics while also allowing him to engage in them. And it's also both the Bad Boys films and Axel Foley here, Axel F., do this interesting thing where they're kind of trying to distance the franchise from some of the more vulgar, more crass, I don't know if I want to say less woke, but like, you can kind of, that's an imprecise term, and I'm going to use that phrase, but like, we understand it's not exactly, this is not a complaint, exactly. What, the movie is trying to deal with that, with like, the perception, like, you couldn't make those movies today with those scripts, with the jokes that they had, and in particular with the kind of male-female dynamic that existed in the old Beverly Hills Cop films or in the first couple of Bad Boys movies.
I'll put it this way. I'll explain it this way. This is not a movie where you ever thought there was any chance that characters would randomly go to a strip club to have a set piece. I'll put it like that is, and that is a thing that happens in the first one. They just like
it happens in the first movie. I believe it happens in the second film. Yeah, it also happens in the first Bad Boys film.
Yep.
I mean,
yep.
There's also a sequence set in a strip club in the fourth Bad Boys film, but yes.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But it's just much more. That's not wrong, but it's much more tame and it's much more silly. Where you just the original was like movies, R-rated movies are for guys and they want some exploitation here. Like let's do some exploitation because exploitative stuff is like people pay their money for it, and you don't get that here. In fact, what you get in all of these films, these updates, is this sense of maybe we have to address that. And we don't quite want to apologize for it because our fans love those movies. But maybe we want to say, we're a little older now. We don't need that anymore. And there's this just this interesting tension between the two new Bad Boys films and Beverly Hills Cop Axel F and their predecessors where they want to have it both ways. And I think, and they want to have this sort of modern approach to, you know, jokes and gender and all of this, but also don't want to quite say those earlier movies, they were problematic. And I don't know. I don't think this is bad necessarily, but I'm not totally sure what I think of it. And there are times when it comes across as slippery, not as like almost like trying to like they walk right up to a line and then say, oh, you know, but we're only walking up to the line here so that we can show you we don't go there anymore.
It is also interesting that both movies are, to a certain extent, about black cops saving the lives and or reputations of white cops.
Yeah. Well, I want to bring this back to a thing that I mentioned briefly in my intro, which is that, you know, in the first one, there's this montage of the streets of Detroit. And you see like real like 1980s Midwestern industrial poverty. And then there's a few minutes later, like 10 minutes into the movie, 15 minutes into the movie, there's a very similar montage in Beverly Hills, and it's like wealth. It's like here is, and like there's some like look at how kind of crazy it is with
and
the
tacky
guys with the big hair, yeah. And like there's a lady with a dog and a pram or whatever. Like there's that sort of thing. And then in this, but it's very different in this movie, in Beverly Hills Cop Axel F, where the montage of Detroit is like, look at Detroit, it's interesting. Not look at Detroit, it's poor and broken down. It's like, look at Detroit, it's kind of interesting. And then the montage of Beverly Hills is the same sort of way. It's like, look at Beverly Hills. It's like kooky and interesting. And that is a very stark difference between the first and the second one, where the first one is a contrast between like poverty and wealth. This is more of a contrast of like two different kinds of interesting.
Well, I would also say that it's a contrast between a community in Detroit. It's like, you know, Axel is like recognized. He's waving to people. He's like, he is in a community that has some rough edges, but that is a recognizably sort of a community. Whereas Los Angeles comes across as sort of louche and vulgar and fallen in a way, right? I mean, you've got this guy who is driving his car while applying this incredibly thick coat of pancake makeup. You have this woman having her kid take photos for her while she poses like an influencer. Like, there's just something sort of off about it. And that you know, it's a shame that the movie doesn't develop that further, because there's a through line between that earliest sequence and the scene that has perhaps the most ideas in it, which is when Kevin Bacon's corrupt character sort of is trying to talk his way out of his confrontation with Axel and says, like, you know, I protect the city and I can't even live in it, right? I mean, he is very specifically resentful of a kind of hyper wealth. And, you know, it's a movie that never really explores this idea, but ends up hinging on this sort of subordinate class status of cops, right? And, I mean, the truth is, like, police officers are often quite well paid because of overtime laws, right? Like, if you look at the sort of the list of, like, highest paid public employees in a lot of states, like, individual police officers are often, like, in Massachusetts and the Northeast, are often among the highest paid public employees in the state because of various, you know, rules about them having to be present for flagging traffic stuff, for, you know, because of overtime rules. But there is, you know, I think something interesting to be done somewhere in pop culture about the idea of police in communities that they can't afford to live in, much like teachers teach in communities they can't afford to live in, but also experiencing sort of a decline in status that once might have kind of made up for the money. And again, that scene, that line, is like maybe the closest Beverly Hills Cop Axel F gets to an interesting idea. And it would have been a much more interesting, but also just not a movie that's of a piece with the franchise, had it done more with the sort of corruption of LA and the sort of the idea that wealth in and of itself is kind of a corrupting thing to be chasing, especially for a cop.
And notably, the screenwriter who worked on this and the Bad Boys films, Will Beall, was an LA homicide and gang detective for a decade before starting a second career as a screenwriter. And I think you see that in both of these franchises, where there is a kind of concern, like in Bad Boys Ride or Die is not like a hyper detailed police procedural, but there is a kind of sense of the movie is quite concerned with sort of the internal workings of the police department, more so, frankly, than the first couple of films were.
Yeah. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Beverly Hills Cop Axel F? Alyssa?
Yeah, it's a perfectly acceptable laundry folding movie.
Peter?
It's literally my thumb is exactly in the middle. It is neither up nor down, because this is the most okay of okay films ever.
It's thumbs up. I mean, look, it's perfectly watchable. You don't go into this expecting war and
anything,
peace, I guess. So it's fine. It's totally fine. It's fine. It's fine. Movie's fine. All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please come land to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.